This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
And this is, again, Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. We're here every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And, of course, the shows are available on podcast the same evening or the next day, whatever. And don't forget, we have a guest today, a very interesting guest. But before we start talking to him, don't forget, as always, if you want to participate in another forum along with this one, you can go to our Facebook page called Occupied Territory, Occupied Territory on Facebook, and I post there every day almost like a blog, and people respond, and you could post things there too. Facebook and Occupied Territory. We have today an author of a recent book, new book, called After Capitalism, Economic Democracy in Action, and it's Dada Mahesh Varananda, and he is here with us on the phone. Hello.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
Excellent, thank you. It's wonderful to be on your show. Thank you.
I'm just going to tell people a little bit about you. I'll just read from the back of the book here. A monk,
okay.
Dada is a monk, writer, social activist, and director of the, is it Prout?
Yes.
Prout, P-R-O-U-T, Prout Research Institute of Venezuela. Maybe you could give us some more background on yourself. I mean, where you come from originally, what you've done in your life, that kind of thing.
Sure. I was born in the United States. I went to, 1971, I went to college, a small college called Earlham College in Indiana.
Oh, sure, I know it. Quaker school, right?
Right, exactly. And it was the time of the Vietnam War, which was very disturbing to me. The more I read about it, the more I thought this is not the way to solve problems. So what happened was I became a conscientious objector first, and a month later I decided to burn my draft card and wrote to the government and told them I'm breaking the law and I'm not going to cooperate anymore. But it was the last year of the war, so 500,000 people were doing it at the same time, so they didn't prosecute me. Friend. And then shortly after that, I learned yoga and meditation as a hobby, and discovered more peace and happiness than I ever thought possible. So at age 24, I went to India and became a monk, a revolutionary monk, that is. And I've been working in Southeast Asia for 14 years, Brazil 11 years, Europe 3 years, and now 6 years or so, and almost 7 in Venezuela.
Mm. The theory, progressive utilization theory,
yes,
or Prout, is original with P.R. Sarkar, right?
That's correct.
Maybe you could explain who he is and then what the theory is, and we can get into
sure.
the book.
Yeah. Sure. Prabhat Ranjan Sarkar was a very interesting person. He died 22 years ago. He was... he was a spiritual master, so he was the guru of the yoga tradition that I started, Ananda Marga. And yet, he was also a social revolutionary, fundamentally against the caste system, the exploitation of women, the exploitation by political parties, and corruption. And so for that reason, he was targeted. He was a political prisoner for 7 years. My first meeting took place with him in his prison cell in India. And I never met anyone who seemed to have so much unconditional love for everyone. So he inspired me to dedicate my life to in the service of humanity. And that's why I became a monk.
The theory, progressive utilization theory, this is something he came up with when he was young or later on. I mean, it's a combination of meditation, psychological observation of human beings, and economic theory sort of combined, right?
Kind Kind of, yes. You know, the theory, and you know, it's a model, right?
Okay.
And it's an alternative to both capitalism and communism. So the model itself stands on its own. You don't need to meditate in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't matter what your beliefs are, because it's based on cooperatives. It's based on the, you know, the economic self-reliance of every region, state, and community as far as possible. It's based on environmental protection of our ecology, and it's based on universal ethical principles. At the same time, there's a neo-humanism is the philosophical base of Prout, and that is the idea that we're all one human family, that we have to take care of everyone. And it's called neo-humanism or new humanism because it's also incorporating the animals, the plants, the inanimate and animate world of nature in our protection, in our family.
So inevitably, it seems to me automatically to go back to a kind of default setting, to use a modern term, of the most ancient kind of Hindu or Buddhist practices where there is no duality. In other words, we are the same as the planet. This has to be part of it then, right?
Sure, you're correct. And at the same time, indigenous people all over the world, you know, they felt very connected with one another and with nature. They didn't say that the land belongs to me. Rather, they say I belong to the land. So it's taking that perspective and putting in the idea that we have a cosmic inheritance, that the planet and all its resources belong to everyone. And we have to share them. And if we do share them, we can live at peace with one another. And so that's why, frankly, I have felt very, very strongly, you know, part of the Occupy movement since it began, mm-hmm. because that's what it's about. It's retaking the commons, and it's utilizing the resources for the welfare of all.
Now, when you say these things, there's absolutely nothing that I'm ever going to disagree with you on. That's why this show is here. I'm setting you up, but
right.
let me do it anyhow. All right. That's very nice of you. So, you know, I am in complete agreement with this. It's something I yearn for. It's why I set this show up, and it's what dictates what I do in other parts of my life, too.
Sure.
However, we are all aware of the fact that what you just said makes a lot of sense to most of the people listening to me, but makes no sense whatsoever. In fact, seems almost dangerous to a whole lot of other people in the world.
Right.
And they're the ones who seem to run everything.
Right.
So, you know, then the segue becomes, how do you realize these principles and beliefs, and mm-hmm. how do you practice them, and how do you get them to be affected?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, this is where we have to go, right?
Sure.
So maybe there's a little bit... maybe we can go back a little bit here. One question is, if we talk about historically, you just mentioned indigenous people. And, you know, I've had conversations like this before. We go back to hunter-gatherer societies, people who are close and who are sharing things.
Okay.
But it seems as if progressively, we look through history, you see less and less of that. But is it just because of certain cultures, like the European culture that spread out all over the world? Because I've read some Chinese history. I've read history mm-hmm. in India. I've read history in other places.
Of course.
There's always people within a society, it's almost like human nature, mm-hmm. that want to have what other people have and not share it, right?
Hmm.
I mean, correct me a little bit, please.
It's a fascinating question, okay? My take on it is that most cultures of the world have, for the most part, been cooperative. Traditional societies, they always considered anyone who was trying to... was extremely competitive or selfish, they considered that a mental disease.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, for a couple hundred years in this country, we've had a very individualistic philosophy, an individualistic attitude. And yet, when I leave the big cities and I travel to the countryside around this country, there's so much more friendliness. There's so much more cooperation, I notice, in rural America than there are in the big cities. People know their neighbors. People communicate with their neighbors much more. So I think that tradition of cooperation is fundamental to human beings, just as the aggressive part of our, the competitive part of our human nature is. And I would say that we could, you know, we could, I teach cooperative games, for example.
Yeah.
Cooperative games are a wonderful way to show people, to let people discover the joys of cooperation. For
so
example, musical.
Yeah. A cooperative game, obviously different than the kind of competitive games that go on in this country, which become even a big business, right?
Right. But just look at musical chairs, right?
Okay. Yeah.
10 kids, there's 9 chairs. You play the music. When the music stops, all the kids try to sit down on the chair, and one kid gets, you know, stuck out, you know? And you do that until you have a winner. What if you do the same game, but nobody's out? So you have 9 chairs, and somehow, you don't tell them how, the kids have to figure out how to all sit on 9 chairs. And
how,
then
and how many kids are we talking? I'm not good at math. How many kids are we talking about here?
I've had 24 adults all sitting in one chair at the end of the game.
So, all right. So we have 9.
They're laughing their heads off. And, you know, they're figuring out how to sit on everybody's lap. You know, you don't tell them how to do it, but somehow they all have to sit and share one chair.
Mm-hmm.
And they're having a great time. And, you know, it's a cooperative game that teaches teamwork.
Mm-hmm.
And that we can all live with less resources than we thought we could. So, like that, there's hundreds of cooperative games. You can find them on the internet. There's no copyright on games like recipes, thank God.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they teach solidarity. They teach kindness. They teach trust. And these are all important for cooperation.
When I look at the, you know, you understand, I guess I'm being like a devil's advocate here, because
sure.
That's sometimes it's sometimes it seems like it's easier to get to the truth, or it's like a, it's my way anyhow.
Of course.
All right.
Go
so,
ahead.
You know, like the oyster, you know, keep rubbing on it, gets a pearl.
Yep.
So, when I look at the world, I look all over the world. I look at the Olympics. I look at professional sports. I look at amateur sports.
Mm-hmm.
My kid was in a soccer league.
Right.
You know, in Manhattan. And this is a, I don't know, you think about Manhattan much? I mean, it's very politically correct in some places in Manhattan, right? And which could be a good thing. They had a soccer league here, and my son was in it. Nobody got a trophy, and nobody got first place or second place or third place. Or at the end, actually, they gave every kid who was in the soccer league a trophy. That didn't stop, of course, a lot of the parents, especially the men, standing on the sidelines, acting like bellowing bulls, you know, telling your kids to knock the other one down and whatever it is. They were trying to teach that. But my son was confused because he looks around and he sees everything in the world, the sports he likes, everything is competitive like in this country. Every sport is competitive. The kind of games you're talking about, I don't see that often.
Yeah.
You know, so
it's true. It's not being played very much here. It's being played a lot in Europe. They have a lot of gymnastics that are all cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's you know, like when you build a pyramid, you know, you got to cooperate, right? So all these kind of things that are getting people without winners or losers, but trying to, you know, challenge yourself, be as great as you can be, have a lot of fun in the process, and, you know, get strong at the same time.
If before you said, you know, this competitiveness as well as cooperation is part of human nature, right?
Right.
So are you suggesting that we're supposed to train ourselves out of one part of human nature or suppress it and then go for the other part?
Well, I wouldn't say suppression. I would say channeling, and I'll explain why.
Okay.
For example, we all have an aggressive instinct, too. When 1,000 years ago you get angry with somebody, you'd probably take out a sword and settle it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Today in the world, in every country of the world, there are laws against violence and murder. And so the idea is that you think 1,000 times before you kill somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't have laws about selfishness and greed, unfortunately. And the same legal principle that says that my rights, I have freedoms until they infringe on the rights of my neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I can play music as loud as I want in my house unless it's my neighbor is right next door, and he's affected by the loud noise, right?
Right.
So it's a basic principle of law. We don't have that. We don't apply that in terms of economics. I can open a business. I can open a Walmart store, put out of business, bankrupt 20 other small stores that have been serving their communities and paying taxes for 20 years, mm-hmm. and there's nothing wrong with that.
Or you could pump for oil and ruin an entire aquifer or community.
Exactly.
Yeah. But why? Why is it that stands out as not having been seen as something that should be cooperative compared to other things? Why did that happen?
Because our economic system and the laws that the economic system are based on are profit, greed, and selfishness. They encourage that. So in Wall Street, the man said, right, greed is good.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because this is fundamental to success in the business world.
But if we've made so many advances all over the world, certainly we have, obviously, mm-hmm. on violence being recognized as something you just don't do.
Right.
Why have we not made similar advances when it comes to greed and profit?
Because of global capitalism. In my opinion, the global capitalist economy is terminally ill. It's terminally ill because it's based on profit every 3 months. You have to show a profit.
Mm-hmm.
So people are not thinking about the long term. They're not thinking about the environment. That's another problem. So the environment's getting destroyed by both capitalist and communist economies, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have the fact that 99% today of investments are speculative rather than productive in nature, like in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
And because so much of it is encouraged to buy on credit, on debt. So the debt, both personal debt of individuals, of companies, and even of the United States country, it's the largest debtor nation in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Borrowing $3.8 billion every day, Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays included. It's not sustainable.
Well, Well, when you think of chicken and egg kind of theories,
right.
What comes first? Was it laws all over the world or adherence to discipline or laws that changed people when it came to violence? Or was it people's general understanding, sort of human evolution of the spirit or soul, that made the laws?
It's a fascinating question. I'm going to mention something else about Darwinism.
Okay.
Darwin was from England, right? He made the theory of evolution about biology, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's Herbert Spencer and another Victorian England, contemporary of Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
He applies Darwinism to society. And he came up with the idea of the survival of the fittest and the idea that the strong should rule.
Mm.
Well, that's fantastic for British imperialism, right?
Mm.
The strong should rule is a justification for England to invade India, for example.
Right.
It's a justification for the United States to take over Philippines and, Puerto Rico and everywhere else they could get.
Right.
And Germany. It was really popular idea, social Darwinism in Germany in the First and Second World War, and you can see why.
Mm-hmm.
It's a justification for Nazism. So, at the same time, you have scientific thinkers. For example, 1960, the On Aggression by Konrad Lorenz from Austria, an anthropologist, saying human nature is fundamentally violent, aggressive, and competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Richard Dawkins from England, the famous biologist, in 1970 publishing the book The Selfish Gene, that human beings are basically selfish creatures.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are selfish. We're also cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
And, many, many scientific studies since then have shown that we have the cooperative nature, too. The trouble is that Hollywood and the advertising and, the media are promoting this selfish story. Look at reality shows.
Mm-hmm.
How many winners do you have in a reality show? Why can't everybody win? Why can't they all cooperate and solve all the problems?
Mm-hmm.
No, because the reality shows want people to stab each other in the back. They want people to, cheat. So cheating on your wives and husbands, that's considered really top stories in Hollywood now.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a child, that was taboo. That wasn't ever mentioned.
No, things have definitely devolved in the United States, because probably you're roughly the same age as I am. I graduated from college in 66, right?
Okay.
All right, so we're generally in the same generation.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Then you don't want to get lost in, which of course is what I do all the time, but, you try not to get lost in the good old days.
Right.
In fact, the kind of masochism and violence and competitiveness that you see everywhere in culture now, certainly in our culture, because that's the one I know best,
right,
would have been considered not puritanically or religiously shocking in some superficial way in the 50s, but just wrong.
Right.
It would be
morally wrong.
Morally wrong. So what happened?
They didn't have movies about heroes who were thieves, for example.
So what happened?
Stealing was considered wrong.
What happened in the last 40 or 50 years? How did the culture become so completely focused and dedicated on greed and money and profit and winning to the exclusion of everything else, that nothing else seems to be even worthwhile talking about to anybody?
Right.
Well, how did that happen?
Well, you live in this country, so you can probably answer better than I. I would suggest certainly advertising, the media, the deregulation of the media, and because when Hollywood, look at Hollywood, because profit, people know, Hollywood executives know that messages don't sell, sex and violence sells. So if you want a profit-making movie, and that's the whole purpose of corporate, Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
is have maximum sex and violence possible, and forget about any kind of moral or social or, uplifting, inspiring, inspirational messages. Those don't sell. Sex and violence, that sells.
I feel like I'm in a funny position of a lawyer arguing a position that I don't even believe in. But why would they keep doing that? In other words, why does it sell? They're not these people who make video
right.
games, these horrible video games,
right.
Hollywood, all the junk on TV, all this trash. People who make all this stuff wouldn't make it if they didn't think people would buy it. And then when they do make it, people lap it up to the tune of billions of dollars. So they're obviously
right.
tapping into something. So are you suggesting that there should be some sort of, some sort of pressure put on, some sort of way of making people not do this? Or how do you do this? How do you change things?
What I'm suggesting is cooperative. I'm suggesting cooperatively owned media. Cooperatively owned media means that you put together journalists, artists of all kinds, and educators together.
Mm-hmm.
And you decide, how can we inform the population? How can we inspire the population? How can we educate the population together? And they can do beautiful, beautiful works. There are really good movies, of course, coming out of even Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
But, the problem is the corporate-owned film industry and TV industry.
But are you suggesting
primarily, based on profit?
So, this makes sense. But how do you go about getting that
in the world?
Yeah. How do you go about? Well, let's try to focus in on because the book, oh, by the way,
right.
again, the book is After Capitalism, Economic Democracy in Action. And the book discusses the history of all these things, how it
mm-hmm.
happened,
mm-hmm.
economic democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the book also, naturally, it has to, provides examples of cooperation in various places in the world, right?
Right.
And so you're saying, and it's clear in the world, that there finally people are understanding that there have to be more cooperative ventures if we're going to sustain ourselves
right.
in the entire planet. It seems to me this has to be done in a smaller basis, because the larger something gets, the more it tends to disconnect itself from the morality of the people.
Exactly. Economic democracy is all about a decentralized economy, local economies of the people, by the people, and for the people, so the people can decide their economic future.
But they would have to detach themselves in some way, and it might be very difficult at the beginning, from the larger entities or structures, right?
Well, there are cooperatives all over the country today, for example. 20,000 cooperatives exist in the United States today. They're providing 2 million jobs. I mean, they do exist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most of those are consumer cooperatives, like credit unions, for example, but there are worker cooperatives, producer cooperatives as well. Now, my point is that I don't think the economic system that we have today is going to continue forever. I don't agree with what CNN tells us.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't think that happiness comes from what you buy, which is what the basis of all advertising. You know, I have a laptop. I use it. It's really not the source of my joy and happiness in my life. It's just a tool, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we need to change the system. And I think by creating models, alternative models,
yeah,
of cooperatives and local economies, and buying locally, locally grown food, we start to create alternatives. But I also think, frankly, that the global economic system is going to crash.
Mm-hmm.
When it's going to crash, I don't know. But when it crashes, suddenly these tiny little models and alternatives are going to become very important, and people are going to want to replicate them everywhere in every community.
Can you
provide jobs for everybody.
Could you give me some examples in other countries?
Sure. I live in Venezuela.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the minimum requirements of life are being guaranteed by the government. They have free health care for everyone, which is a wonderful thing. When you get sick, you walk into any clinic and the doctors, and, you know, they'll treat you.
Mm-hmm.
They built 200,000 homes for homeless people in the last year. Their target is 2 million homes in the next 4 years. I can't translate student loans there because they have free universities.
Hmm.
They have public universities that cost about $20 every month for tuition. It's hard for me to explain that to Venezuelans, what U.S. students are going through with student loans.
Of course, the United States, with corporate, you know, a complete cooperation of corporations,
right,
especially oil corporations,
right,
and our secret services here,
right,
tried as hard as they could to squash all this.
Right. Right. Right.
But they didn't, thank God.
But they didn't.
Yeah.
And Venezuela's booming. They have a food co-op there, for example. It's been running 47 years now. It's called Secosa Sola, which means the cooperative network of the state of Lara, but now it's in 5 states. It's not just in Lara.
Mm-hmm.
In Barquisimeto, they sell food. 55,000 people shop there every week. And it's only open 4 days a week. And they sell, total sales, $100 million. So it's this huge co-op, food co-op in Venezuela. And like that, there's a fantastic housing cooperative in Uruguay. There are models of cooperative successes everywhere,
what?
But they're like invisible because the media never tells you about the success rate.
Because the media is owned by corporate entities, right? So you, obviously one important thing to do would be to have a large, effective cooperative media that was available to everybody. The Internet serves that somewhat.
It's working that way, exactly.
Yeah.
And your radio station is providing that service as well, for
true,
example, your show.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the things I discovered is that, you know, statistically, 50 to 80% of new private businesses fail in the first year of operation, 50 to 80%.
Hmm.
And only 10% of cooperatives fail in the first year. And after 5 years, it's got so 95 to 97% of private businesses have failed within 5 years of operation, of opening.
Mm-hmm.
And only it's still 88% of cooperatives are still running. Those are statistics.
Well,
and
obviously,
yet the business news never tells you those statistics.
Well, then, of course, because the business news is probably owned by some corporation or Forbes or something like that. So,
and they're for investors. And cooperatives are totally boring for investors because you can't buy them out. You can give them a loan, get 3% interest, you know, whatever interest, you know, on a loan.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't buy them out. You can't sell them. You can't break them up and destroy them either.
I guess one of the reasons cooperatives work, too, is because they actually, or generally, I should say, or usually own the building or the land on which they operate.
Sure.
So they don't have to pay rent or buy.
Right.
Yeah. Pay a mortgage.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
See, let me ask you a question about, since you studied yoga and, you know,
right.
you meditated.
Meditation.
Obviously, it's a very spiritual life that you've led and that you lead.
Right.
What do you see as religion's role in the world with all this? Because the way I look at religion, certainly organized religion throughout the world, it is very, unfortunately, it is often cooperated with the state entities to keep things stratified, you know.
Right.
So how do you see it? Can it help? Or should we just abandon it as a bunch of old-fashioned mythology that tends towards the worst in human nature?
I differentiate between fundamentalism, what I consider dogma, which instills fear in people, calls for blind obedience, and divides people between us and them, between believers and non-believers. We're going to heaven, you're all going to hell. To me, that's a tragic, tragic outlook on life. And true spirituality, in my opinion, is the opposite. Instead of instilling fear, it instills love. It calls for questioning, open-mindedness, and it sees all human beings as one human family. So that connection and that connectedness to everyone and everything, to nature very much, is what I see as spirituality and what I see as benefiting the world. And there is, of course, a mystical, spiritual part of every religious tradition, and yet many religions have become dogmatic, fundamentalist, fanatic, and that's what's killing the world.
So as far as political systems go, are there cooperative towns or cooperative municipalities or cooperative places where are actually the very running of things day by day? After all, there have to be streets, there has to be sewage,
right.
there has to be lighting, there has to be maybe some police, fire. Are there actual cooperative towns rather than run, you know, top down?
Sure. And it's interesting because there's different models of governance, right? For example, all the tribal peoples in the world generally had a council of elders. The idea that the people with more experience would hopefully together would choose more wisely, you know, the decisions that the tribe has to make. So if a young warrior wants to go to war, you know, he has to go to the tribe of elders and they say, nope, we first have to, you know, talk this through and try to avoid the war. Then you have political democracy, of course, which came from Europe and was very different than Asia. In Asia, they had the idea of the wise leader. China, for 5,000 years, they tried to have a Taoist sage, a benevolent leader. And sometimes a tyrant would take over, and then they'd look for a hero who can mobilize the people and, again, recapture power and have a benevolent rule.
That's one of the most recurrent myths and cultural traditions in China. You see that, that cycle over and over again.
And then you have Europe. And Europe, coming from a Christian tradition, of course, the idea that we're all sinners, so who are your representatives going to be? Obviously, they're also going to be sinners, or rather mediocre leaders. And so the emphasis is on checks and balances to prevent any leader from, you know, because power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely,
so
right?
That's very interesting. So the idea is that the basic assumption of a place like the United States of America is that we are inherently sinners, so we have to watch each other and check each other and balance each other.
And we're always going to have mediocre leaders. And being a political leader is constantly compromising and constantly, you know, selling out, basically. Now, the other type of governance is participatory democracy, which the New England town hall meetings used to be, right? And they still are in some small places. The idea that everybody gets together, and as long as a majority is there, they decide collectively what their priorities. In Brazil, they did participatory budgeting, where communities decide their priorities. And in Venezuela, where I live today, there are now 33,000 communal councils.
Really?
This is a community of 400 people, a neighborhood, right? And 400 or less families. And they get together, they decide their priorities, fixing up the park, paving the road, fixing the sewage system. They decide all the problems they want to solve, and they choose the top two priorities. They write project proposals for this. They have automatically a cooperative communal bank, and the government will fund their top priority. So every community in the country is choosing their future. Nobody's deciding from the capital what they're going to fund. They decide what they're going to fund, and they get the funds for it. So it's an empowerment, community empowerment, and that's participatory democracy, just as, of course, the Occupy movement.
Right.
All the General Assemblies were face-to-face, consensus-based, participatory democracy.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up, because this show is called Occupied Territory, and it's not about Palestine and Israel. It's about the fact that corporations, greed, and big government have occupied, all of our lives in a way which is very, bad. But in the course of doing the show, I got in touch with, I made it clear, what my attitude was about this whole thing, which is what I was very much in favor of. I got in touch with dozens and dozens of Occupy sites and Occupy groups in cities all over the country and in Canada and everywhere. I often, I got a lot of interesting people on, but I often got back responses. This is usually always by email, right? Because I'm an old guy. I don't text. Anyhow, response was, we have to put this before the committee, whatever it was, the subcommittee on media, and B, we will get back to you as soon as possible. Often, I never heard from these people. Now, here we are having a discussion about how essential, by the way, if you're just tuning in, it's we're talking to a fascinating man here and somebody who's written a fascinating book, Dada Mahesh Varananda, and he is a monk, writer, social activist, and director of the Prout Research Institute of Venezuela. And the book is called After Capitalism, Economic Democracy in Action. So here I am talking to people who are operating in small groups completely horizontally, right? And so they appoint committees. I can understand that. And then I get in touch with the media committee. Either I never hear back, or I hear back that they voted not to do it. Now, here I am offering them something which you would think, I went down to Zuccotti Park a couple of times, right?
Right.
And I informed some people there who I found were in the media, and they were extremely suspicious of me. I could understand that, but I don't know how I could have made it clearer to people. And I got actually very little cooperation from these cooperatives in my effort to help them. So it was a difficult thing. Maybe you could comment on that, or maybe you have an opinion about why that might have happened. My feeling was the horizontalness went so far that it disintegrated itself.
At times, there is a science of consensus decision-making, and that science actually shows that, it prevents one person from blocking the group from making a positive decision. Because if you don't understand consensus-making well, that can happen. One person with a loud mouth can just prevent anybody from else making the decisions that he or she doesn't want made.
Well, we've all seen that in our lives.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, but face-to-face participatory democracy does work, and committees do work if, you follow the right principles. So I would recommend to them to study the consensus principles again so that,
Here's a question that fits right into this. The Occupy movement, the principles of Prout and everything else, and what you studied in India. For instance, India. I mean, you had a charismatic leader, and very few people have been as charismatic as that in, the last 1,000 years, in India, who, by virtue of his good deeds, his influence, his intellect, and his humility, and whatever else that you can't even put your finger
on. Mahatma Gandhi?
Correct.
Right.
Organized mass demonstrations of civil disobedience against the British imperialists.
Right.
And it was successful. There are a lot of, the oldest theory in the world for historians is that the man that makes the times and times makes the man. Throwing a woman to that, too.
But, exactly.
It seems to me often that, for instance, in this country, we had Martin Luther King. I wonder sometimes, without Martin Luther King or Mahatma Gandhi, would such movements have been successful?
You know, both are true. We need moral leaders. And one of the things is that anyone can become a moral leader by setting a personal example of integrity, of courage to fight injustice, and personal example mm-hmm. by walking their talk. I have lived in Latin America, where I have seen Marina Silva in Brazil, for example. She was illiterate to the age of 11. She was a rubber tapper's daughter in the Amazon, and she became one of the most fiery revolutionary speakers I've ever heard, and became Minister of the Environment, now running for president.
Mm-hmm.
And I've met many, many people like that who, you know, no education. And yet, with the landless people's movements and other social movements, they're very, very inspiring leaders. I would follow them. So an individual, just as you said, an individual can lead society, and society, you know, we can all become the leaders that we've been waiting for.
But there is human nature. I mean, but some people seem to have a natural talent. You could use the phrase God-given, but I don't.
Sure.
You know, they have a talent for influencing other people, even either for the good or for the bad. And that is the. I mean, in any group, when you were growing up, when I was growing up, there was always somebody who seemed to be the leader because they had a focus or they knew what they were doing or a certain energy. This is the way of life. I guess what you're saying is we have to develop a kind of a societal or universal societal consciousness that that kind of thing is useful, but it shouldn't be the be-all and end-all, right?
Yes, and also there are an awful lot of books and courses about leadership training. Why? If we're just doing talent scout searching, what's the need for that? Well, because we know today that anybody can become a good leader if they follow certain principles and practices. So, yes, I know some kids in school who were extremely popular, and after school, their lives just burned out. You know, their popularity of school was not, they didn't have the strength and stamina to overcome the challenges that they face later on in life.
I guess charisma unattached to a morality or to to a larger goal is a useless thing, right?
Exactly. And can even be dangerous.
You know, in Venezuela, you describe what's gone on there, and we've done shows here on Hugo Chavez. One of my friends, Greg Pallast, has been on here.
Good. Man, yes.
Yeah, and so he explained a lot about Venezuela, probably knows it better than most journalists in the world. So, and then, you know, you were talking about India, and then we talked about Gandhi, and all kinds of other places in the world. During the austerity in Greece, you had a million people, 2 million people on the street in a small country.
Right.
Protests against the war in Europe were far bigger than here. Why is it in this country? Now, let's just absent for a moment the militarized response of the police, which was awful here, and the control of the media, which ridiculed the Occupy movement. Why is it that with things so bad and with things so out of control that you don't see a mass student demonstration or a mass demonstration of people in their 20s or 30s just pouring? Their people are unemployed. They have debt that's killing them. They don't have a place to live. They don't have something to eat. Life is really almost meaningless here, morally, intellectually. People are without, and they're without. They don't have jobs. Why are they not out in the streets in the millions here, do you think?
You know, when I need to heat some water, I put a pot of water on the burner and turn it on, and I watch it, and absolutely nothing happens. I stare, I watch, I wait, I wait, I wait, and nothing seems to be happening. And then, poof, the whole thing boils and transforms. It can't do that except for all the time that it seemed as though nothing was happening. What's happening in our society today seems like nothing. It seems like the Occupy movement's dead. It's not. Consciousness is being raised. Society is transforming. People are becoming aware. And yet, it looks like nothing's happening. And how when, you know, 300 people or something went to Wall Street to occupy it? How did, within 2 months, there's 850 sites around the world of Occupy? Who planned that? Nobody. What organization led that? No organization led it. Rather, the people themselves came out spontaneously because it resonated. The idea of we are the 99% resonated in people. So it's not dead. It's very much alive. And we have to tap into that awakening, that consciousness, and mobilize people again.
Here's a follow-up question, you know, on that. One of the reasons, just one of the reasons why, and there are many, and you know them and I know them, one of the reasons why the Occupy sites, you know, had to go or disappeared was because of extraordinarily brutal behavior by the authorities.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the militarized
right.
police
right.
all over
right.
the place.
Right.
Department of Homeland Security in this country mm-hmm. Gave close to $100 million to various communities to you know, update their military tactics and weapons.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So that's one of the reasons. In India, you had the British colonial authorities. I mean, think of Amritsar, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
right.
they didn't hesitate when they thought they needed to just murder people and to shoot
right.
people and beat people and lock
right.
people up. So
right.
in all other places in the world, it seems to me that sometimes when people need to claim the commons back or
mm-hmm.
Take society back for themselves, mm-hmm. they have to pay a price for it. Do you think that's true?
Yes. And that the price that will, well, you know, first you're giving your time. First you're giving yourself. The more you give, the more you get.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, to fight social injustice requires courage and bravery. And, you know, violence, institutional violence is taking place every day today. So even though we try to be as nonviolent as we can, it doesn't mean that people aren't getting hurt. People are getting hurt when the police take over the Occupy site, and they're very violent about how they do it sometimes. Not all police, but sometimes. So, yes, you're quite right that the powers that be don't want it to happen. You know, the Frank Luntz, you know, all your listeners know about Frank Luntz, right? He was this conservative thinker, strategist, who tells conservatives how to talk.
Right.
And he told them, the Occupy movement scares me very much. So when, you know, because it's become so popular, now the polls, you know, were showing that more than 50% of Americans support the ideas of the Occupy Wall Street movement. And so he said, when anybody asks you about Occupy, you say, I hear you, I get it. Mm. That was the reply that would make Republicans sound good. And the other things he teaches, of course, is, you know, you talk. Never use the word capitalism or capitalist.
Hmm.
You call them job creators. And you call global capitalism, you call it economic freedom. So the idea of amassing wealth without any limits is some kind of human right, a freedom, a wonderful thing, rather than exploiting the planet.
Hmm. I just printed out an article yesterday. A FOIA request was put in by some activist civil rights mm-hmm. Justice group to
right.
Homeland Security. And they got hundreds of documents back, which they think is probably about a tenth of it,
mm-hmm.
about how Homeland Security was very actively involved in
right.
observing and, in some cases, doing more than observing the Occupy movement.
Yes.
I guess it's a difficult thing if you want to take back the world that you live in from the people who now own and run it,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
right? So
right.
this in this book, After Capitalism,
right.
Economic Democracy in Action, which I presume people could get by going to Amazon. And
of course, Barnes & Noble, yes.
Okay.
Also my website, which is
oh, yes.
aftercapitalism.org.
Aftercapitalism.org. And
yes.
There will be ways, if people go there, to participate in things that are local, or not just theory, but there will be actual ways to participate.
I'm not connected to everybody, so I can't do everything, no. But the book is available there,
okay.
and they can see my speaking schedule. I'm on a 30-day tour of 24 cities.
Oh, okay.
So talking at a lot of college campuses, libraries, radical bookstores, and etc.
Mm-hmm. And so if you when you go, that's the last question here, and I appreciate you sticking around for so long because I know you have a busy schedule. When you go to a college and speak to them,
yes,
it's one of your goals to sort of energize and create an awareness so that they would actually go out into the world and participate in this kind of retaking
very
the commons.
So. Yeah? You know, I explain what Prout is because I think the model of economic democracy and the progressive utilization theory, they're models that work.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it's informative. The second part is empowering. I tell the kids, you know, you have a potential, physical, mental, and spiritual, more than you can possibly imagine. Meditation is an ancient practice that's practiced in almost every culture of the world to calm your mind, to strengthen your mind, to focus your mind, because with a strong and peaceful mind, you can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one is to give inspiration and hope, because together we can change the world. Together, nothing's impossible. And so, yes, that's my purpose,
mm-hmm.
and that's why I go. And you know, follow your bliss, what Joseph Campbell said.
Mm-hmm.
We need a revolution based on love. And so the ecological theme that you think globally and act locally makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because whatever you do positive in your local community, that makes the world a better place. You contribute to changing the world. And every small drop that you put in is eventually making an ocean that will tear down this crazy global capitalist system.
You know,
it's not going to last forever.
I just got through rereading Kim by Rudyard Kipling.
Oh, yes.
And it's a fascinating book, and Kipling was a fascinating guy with all his white man's burden crap.
Right.
But, you know, his understanding of the spirituality
mm-hmm.
of the East is really quite extraordinary, although
yes.
he never seemed to digest it right. But
right.
And
he appreciated it.
What you just said reminded me of something that he has a llama in there, you know, who was one of the
mm-hmm.
central characters. And
mm-hmm.
every time something happens in there, he said, an action has just been set loose in the world. Whatever you just did,
mm-hmm.
you have to understand. He's got this acolyte who's the hero
right.
of the book, Kim.
Right.
Whatever you just did, it's going to have reverberations instantly
right.
and outward, like ripples.
Right.
And I guess that's what you're out there trying to tell
exactly.
all these kids, right?
Yes.
It's really quite extraordinary. Well, I'm glad you're out there. Can you give the website one more time?
Aftercapitalism.org. And also, I invite people to check the Prout Research Institute of Venezuela, Priven.org, because we're looking for volunteers who want to come down to Venezuela and help. And there's an application process, and we'd love to have you come down there.
All right. Listen, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you, Mike.
And okay.
keep up with your great show.
Thank you. What do we have, like 2 minutes left there? Okay, so check out, we're going to have the podcast of this up on Occupied Territory, the Facebook page. And I'll probably make some commentary on this on the Occupied Territory Facebook page. Also, if you want to get in touch with me, you can go to Feder Files, FederFiles.com. And I do one other show on this station, which is related a lot to this. It's not specifically political, but it's about similar topics about, you know, love versus hate, you know, your actions, being responsible for your actions. But I tell stories. There's some cultural things. I'll talk about movies, talk about anything. This is on Mondays. It's called The Turning Point, Mondays at 4 p.m. It's all the same thing. It's all related. It's all together. So that's it for this week. I'll be back on Monday for The Turning Point at 4 p.m. and next Thursday for Occupied Territory at 2 p.m. when we have another guest who's written a book on the Occupy movement. Thank you.